I really feel deep down today that there's something wrong within the evangelical thinking of a lot of good, fine, born-again Christians. Sometimes it's easy for us to overemphasize one attribute of God and overlook some other attribute, or at the expense of another attribute. What I'm talking about here is today that within the evangelical movement there is great emphasis on the grace of God. And I agree with this, that God is a great, gracious, kind, loving, considerate God, and that no man can gain forgiveness of sin, gain merit in God's eyes, gain heaven by his own sheer good works. I have said that time and again on the program, and I sincerely believe it's true. We are saved by grace through faith. It's not of works. Now, the Bible says that, and so I accept this is true. And so when we are saved, we're saved surely by the grace of God. And yet with this attitude, I find a lot of Christians then going on to say, well, if God's grace is going to give me the gift of salvation and I can do nothing to gain it, nothing to earn it, nothing to merit it, if it's just a gift, well, I don't have to worry about sin. I don't have to worry about being obligated to God in any way. If I'm going to be given salvation by grace, I can forget about the holiness of God. I can forget about all the other aspects that God stands for besides grace. And I think this is the great danger we face today. We make salvation a gift that's free, and it is, and yet we seem to imply, well, if it's a gift, then there's no obligations to it. And I think that's where we make the great mistake today in the church. A wedding ring that is given by a boy to a girl. Now, I didn't say the engagement ring. I said the wedding ring. Is a free gift to her. It cost her absolutely zero to get that wedding ring. But I might go on. She gets the ring by grace. That is because the boy just outright loves her. She didn't earn it. She didn't work for it. Maybe she doesn't even deserve it. But anyway, the boy out of grace just gives her the ring because he wants her to have it. But that gift requires of that girl, if she accepts the wedding ring now, it requires of her certain obligations. And so it is a gift, all right, but it's a gift, you might say, with some strings attached to it. Now, she doesn't do anything to get the gift, but the person that gives it to her expects her to do some things if she is going to have the gift. So I think on the end of the giver, there is more than just saying, I want you to have a gift and now you can go your merry way and forget all about me. The gift of salvation has some strings attached to it. Not to get the gift, but to please the person who gives it to you. I believe we're going to have to be more concerned about the obligations attached to the gift of salvation than today the church is giving. And I believe we're having a great mistake in our Christian witnessing and in our evangelistic outreach and trying to get people to accept Jesus as their Savior. We're still overlooking that old, old story. Jesus Christ must be the Lord. And there's your obligation catch. Jesus says, I'll give you salvation, but I expect you after you get the gift to obligate yourself to treat me as your Lord. Almost the identical situation you have in a marriage ceremony. What is the obligation that the free gift imposes upon the person who receives it? Put simply, what do I owe Jesus for the gift? Or what does he expect me to give him for the gift? Now, the gift is yours already. I want to say that again. But it's a gift that calls for obligations to be fulfilled on your part. What obligations, you say? Very simple. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, and with all thy mind. That's it. The same obligation that a girl or a boy, in a real sense, has towards the one that gives them the wedding ring. No different. But what an obligation this is. The obligation brought upon us by the free gift of salvation is just simply to love the giver. To love him with all our heart. You know, that's one of the real questions that Jesus oftentimes kept asking people. Especially did he ask this of Peter. Following the denial, He came to Peter and after the resurrection and asked him, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter said, "Yes." And he asked him a second time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Yes." He asked him a third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Yes." Peter made a comment. He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know I love you." I'm not sure of this, but very possibly Jesus was trying to get Peter to define love for him. Today we use the word love very recklessly, not really knowing how to define the word. We can speak it, but really when it comes down to showing it or proving it, well, that's another thing, isn't it? That's not quite so easy. What is the sure way to test the genuineness of somebody's professed love? Now, those within my church are going to find these words today very familiar because it hasn't been very long since I preached this message in church. But I felt a burden that I want to share this with the radio audience, and I normally do not ever preach any sermon that I preached at church real soon on the radio. But this one here I have a burden for, and I just want to share it with you this morning because I think it's important to you. Because a husband may say to his wife, "Honey, do you love me?" Or the wife may ask the husband, "Do you love me?" But I believe it's the question that God very often asks, as Jesus did himself, being God on earth. "My child, do you love me?" Now you have my gift, but the question I'm asking you is, "Do you love me?" Now how can you test the genuineness of a person's professed love? That's the question this morning I want to deal with. And I'm going to answer it by taking up two stories found in the Bible, one in the Old Testament, which gives us the answer to our question, how do you test the genuine love? And the other in the New Testament is an illustration of the answer that we're going to give you. The first one comes from the book of 2 Samuel, the last chapter. You know the story probably very well. God had been bringing judgment upon Israel because of their great sins. And David was told by God that he would withhold his judgment upon Jerusalem if David would build him an altar. You know, always when a person goes before God at the altar, that's the place where a man confesses his sins and admits God is right in his judgment and asks for God's mercy. That's, of course, where God's mercy is given. And so God is telling David to build an altar. And there come and meet with him, and God would withhold the judgment from Jerusalem. And that's where our story takes up now, in the book of 2 Samuel, the 24th chapter, the 18th verse. "And Gad came that day to David and said, 'Go up now and build an altar unto the Lord. And you are to build it in the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite.' And David, according to the saying of Gad, did go up as the Lord commanded to build an altar." Now, verse 21. "And Arunah was a Gentile. He was not a Jew. He was a Jebusite, not a Hebrew. And Arunah said," but King David was, of course, king over him also. His land was within the bounds of the land of Israel. "And so he said, 'Wherefore has my king come to me a servant?' And David said, 'I have come for a purpose, and that as I wish to buy the threshing floor from you. And there I wish to build an altar unto the Lord, that the plague may be stayed that is now upon our people.' Arunah said to David, 'Let my lord the king take and offer what seemeth good unto him to his God. Behold, not only will you have a spot you want, but here are some oxen that you can have for burnt offering. And here are some threshing floor instruments and other instruments that you may use of mine free of charge.'" Now you see, since it was being asked by the king of a subject, and since it was for the Lord of Israel, Arunah said, "I will not sell, but I will give it to you." But on the other hand now, David was a man coming to worship God. And you must worship God how? In truth, in justice, in fairness, in righteousness. You see, that's the way you worship God. And because he was coming to worship the Lord, David that I cannot take. That would not be fair. I will not be dishonorable in my dealings with you. I cannot take an unfair advantage of you just on the name of religious worship. And so we read verse 24, and the king said to Araunah, no, I cannot take it for nothing, but I will buy it from thee at a price. For I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God of that which does cost me nothing. Now here is the test of genuine love. I will not offer to God what costs me nothing. I will not offer to my wife what costs me nothing. Now, Araunah's offer to David gave David a chance to prove that he was a fair man. It also gave David a chance to prove how much he loved God. It was going to cost David to worship. It was going to cost David to love the Lord. Now, a gracious heart, you see, will not serve God with that which costs that gracious heart absolutely nothing. Nor can a true Christian person deem that true devotion which involves absolutely no sacrifice on his own part. What I'm saying is, the Christian who loves the Lord will not take advantage of grace, will not take advantage of the love of God for his child. He will not give back to God that which cost him nothing. For the gift that God has given to the Christian costs God everything. And in return for the love, for God so loved the world, how do we know God's love is genuine? Because the love cost him something. He would not love us with a love that cost him nothing. He didn't just shout down from heaven, I love you down there, sinners. No, we know God loved us, and his love was genuine because it was a love that cost him something very dear. Something very dear indeed. It cost him his son. It cost his son his life. And there's a test of genuine love. Now, old carnal nature, old selfish self, you see, it jumps at the chance to take advantage of grace, to take advantage of somebody else, to get something for nothing, to figure out a way you can get somebody's land or get somebody's gift or get somebody's treasures away from them at the least price possible and then go away gloating how you've cheated them. Ah, but that's not love. That's greed. Now, the evidence of genuine love is nothing is too good for the one I love. And let's go on and say nothing is too good for the Lord that I love. And so, sure enough, in verse 24, David said, I'll not give God what costs me nothing. In 25, David bought, and David built, and David worshipped, and God accepted what David did. It was pleasing in his sight, and God withheld further judgment upon the land of Jerusalem. I might add by that God proves he is pleased with that kind of devotion and love that David showed there that day in that threshing floor. For you see, such proof meant to David that what he was doing was really evidence that he loved the Lord. His worship was going to show God that he loved God. And how can you do that? Just simply by giving God what cost him something. When David came to worship God, he said, God, look not just at the sacrifice on the altar, but look at the sacrifice that I have made. Look at the sacrifice I have paid. Look at my sacrifice, God, not at the sacrifice upon the altar. How do you test the genuine love? It's a love that costs something of the one who claims that they love you. Let me give a quick illustration. A boy tells a girl, he loves her. Those magic words that eventually lead to the wedding altar. And he says, I want to marry you. Now to prove his love is genuine, the boy stops at a store and buys a package of chewing gum. He puts the piece of gum in his mouth and takes the tinfoil wrapper and he rolls it and twists it up and he makes a ring for his lover and he puts it on her finger and he says, here, dear, is your engagement ring. He gets the gum and she gets the wrapper. But he says, I love you, sweet. Do you see how much I love you? Or, let's take a step up. He takes you to Woolworths or some 5 and 10 cent store and goes in and buys a play ring. Then, takes out a pocket change in his hand and purchases a ring, and he presses the two sides together so it'll fit her finger, and places the ring on her hand and says, "Now this is your engagement ring." While in the store, he takes her over to another door part of the store, another department, and he sees a pair of water skis he'd like to have for himself, and so he opens his billfold up and he peels out $200 for a set of water skis. Or let's say that same young man goes to a jewelry store and he asks to see a 1-carat diamond. And the girl says, "You can't afford that, honey." He says, "I know I can't afford it, but I know what I want you to have. And this is the ring that I feel like I want you to have. This ring reveals I really love you. And I'm willing to do without. I'm willing to save and scrimp and even work extra jobs that you might have that ring. Let me ask you something. Which one of those boys would you like to marry?" I tell you right now, I'd pick that last one. I'd pick the one that would just give me a gum wrapper, and the one that would spend all his money on himself and give me a play ring. I tell you, I don't think that'd be very good fit material for love, would you? I don't see much love and devotion ever coming out of that kind of person. But the person that's willing to deny himself of things he'd like to have, that I might have this thing that he feels would please me, there is a person that is mature. There is a person that knows what love is all about. And there's the way you test genuine love. A person says, "God gives you what costs me nothing." Now, love, you see, is measured by the sacrifice involved. Again, I'll repeat the saying, love does not give what cost it nothing. Now, let me say this, everything costs something. Even the package of gum costs something. So everything, in a sense, that any Christian would give to God cost him something. But I want to say this, it often comes from where that package of gum came from. It comes from where that ring in that 10-cent store came from. It comes from the surplus. It comes from the pocket change. And oftentimes, you see, we say we love God, and all we give God is that surplus money. "Oh, I give God a dime this week." Well, don't you think God's happy with that? "My, that's wonderful of you. I'll give God my spare time. I don't have anything else planned today. Nobody's called. Nothing's come up. Man, nothing exciting that's going to take place. I guess there's just nothing else left to do. Maybe I'll go to church today." Well, isn't that wonderful? Now, that's a real test of genuine love. You can't find anything better to do. You got a little spare time left. No way in the world to spend it, so you might let God have a little of it. Now, is that genuine love? Then there are labors, you see. What we sometimes give God is what we would have wasted anyway. Wasted on ourselves, or wasted on something or somebody else. In other words, do you give God what never sets you back anyway? Never interferes with your plans anyway? That doesn't deny you of anything at all? That never places you in any kind of bind whatsoever? That never inconveniences you of anything? Never puts you out of the way at all? Is that what you give to God? Well, if it is, brethren, that's not love. That's not love at all. And yet a lot of folks attempt to worship God in this very way. They try to give God what costs them nothing. They give their surplus. They give what they wouldn't use, don't want to use, have no need of. They give God the scraps. They get the apple and God gets the core. They give God their spare money, if they have any. Their spare time, if they have any. Their spare labors, if they have any. And then they sing, "Oh, how I love Jesus." Brethren, that's not right. Because God took note of what David did and God was pleased. And I tell you, if God was pleased with what David did, God is only pleased when we do the same thing. And that is, give unto him that which cost us dearly. I think God is honored when you do that. When you have to do without that God might have. Brethren, God's heart is impressed. When God had to do without a son that I might have salvation, that impressed me. For God to be loved, and for me to have to do without someone to love him, that love is genuine. I'll not give God what costs me nothing. And so when you give unto God, brethren, it ought to be of such a magnitude and such a gift that it costs you something. It's costing you some trips, some plans, some time, some money, some interest. It's cost you dearly. Now, the illustration of our story very quickly is found in the book of John, the 12th chapter. It's also in Matthew 26, 6 through 13, but we'll look at John 12, 1 through 8. It's a familiar story. would not be long now until Jesus would be crucified. Beginning with verse 1 in John, the 12th chapter, if you have a Bible, read with me. Then Jesus, just 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, where he had been dead and raised from the dead by Jesus. And so they made a supper. And Martha served. Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with Jesus. And then came Mary with a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. And then said one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? This he said not because he cared about the poor, because he was a thief, and he kept the treasury bag of the disciples, and he oftentimes took out what was put within. Then said Jesus, let her alone. Let her alone. I like that answer. Let her alone. She's done a good thing today. Now let's look at what Mary did. Mary loved Jesus, and she wanted to show it to him. How did she do it? Just say, Jesus, I love you. No. She would not give Jesus what cost her nothing. And she took, therefore, the most precious thing she had. It was really a bottle of perfume, a pound of perfume. And it would probably have cost a year's wages. Have you ever given a year's wages to the Lord? Well, that'll cost you something. You know, that'll cost you something. She gave what would represent a year's wages, or what could be used to feed 5,000 people. And Jesus came along and saw this, and he said, what a waste, what a waste, what a waste. This woman's crazy. Why, she should have taken that money, and there's a much better use for it. What, give it to Judas? Now, Jesus was not concerned about the waste. He was just concerned that she didn't waste it on him. He didn't get a hold of it. But I want to say Jesus said, let her alone. Why? Because Christ was impressed by her love and devotion for him. Not only that, but I want to say this. Jesus said, this deed shall be remembered. And of course it is. We have it written in the Bible. She did what? She gave of her best to the Master. And brethren, whenever you give of your best to the Master, that's not a waste. That's never a waste. And God is touched. He was by David. Jesus was by Mary. God still is touched by a heart that loves to the point that he'll give that which cost him something. Love has a tendency to be extravagant. Love has one desire, to give to the uttermost limits. And when love has given all it can give, love is dissatisfied in saying, I wished I had more to give. Brethren, a gift is deemed of little value if you can easily afford it. But when you have to sacrifice to give somebody something to show them you love them, then that present takes on an added value. Judas represents to all people the picture of a person filled with greed and selfishness who says, it's a waste to give unto God that which costs you something. Mary is a picture of a person who is devoted and loves the Lord, a person who says, I'll not give God what costs me nothing. In Mary's gift, we see the real, genuine definition of love. There are in every church, there are in mine, people who have done without things that they might give to the radio program, to the church, to the missionary program. People who have put off trips, put off plans that they could come and work and serve in the church. There are people like this everywhere. They give to God what costs them something. Why? Because they feel their salvation obligates them to love God. And you're going to love God, there's only one way to do it. As loving anybody else, you have to give them that which costs you something.